from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you very much for tuning in to WPR in our southwestern region. We're talking about the La Crosse area and the Cooley region's response to COVID-19. In particular, today we're starting off our conversation with the major medical providers in our area, where you've got Dr. Paul Mueller, who's the CEO of Mayo Health Clinic System for Southwest Wisconsin, and Dr. Scott Rathgaber, who's the CEO of Gunderson Health System here in La Crosse and throughout our region as well. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us and for sharing some important information with us today.
Thank you for having us.
So I should mention that in La Crosse County, we have had several more cases this week of the coronavirus being confirmed. So far, no deaths in La Crosse County. I know in Monroe County, they have a few cases now. And then north of our exact location, but still within our listening area in Winona County in Minnesota, I think they have experienced their first death related to this. And so this is certainly an issue that is top of mind for everyone in our community, even as the safer at home order from Governor Evers is still in place. Let me start with Dr. Mueller by asking, from your perspective at Mayo, how is everything going in terms of the community's reaction and your own system's reaction to COVID-19?
Things are going well. We have a tremendous community, and the community has been very supportive of our work, and I know of Gunderson Health System's work as well. We are all in this together, and we rely on our community to practice good hand hygiene, don't touch your face, social distancing. Really, that is the most important gift you can give to our health systems, because the fewer people who are sick, the fewer will require hospitalizations and the critical supplies we need to function. So we really, really appreciate the community's support. My own observations and those of others is that is going really well. Regarding our staff, they have also been tremendously responsive. We've pivoted the operations of our hospital and our clinics from routine care just a couple of weeks ago to really being poised to handle the surge of cases that we anticipate and what's being experienced elsewhere in our hospitals and in our clinics. And we can go into more details about that later.
And that's exactly what I hope to do. But Dr. Rathgaber, I want to give you a chance to respond and update us on Gunderson's efforts in this regard, and in particular, how your staff is holding up.
Well, yeah, I echo Paul's comments about the community. It's really put us in a very good position because we have such a great community that is following the safe at home recommendations, washing hands, keeping socially distant. That is a gift. And so I think we have to reiterate that over and over again. We have also been working with our partners at Mayo and the health department so that we can be consistent in our response. And I think that's been a really big and encouraging part of what we've been doing, so that we're unified and we're cooperating together for the benefit of our community. Gunderson has been, preparing. Again, we shut down our elective and non-urgent work a couple of weeks ago as well, and it's all been about preparation from that time on, learning from the other parts of the country and waiting in anticipation of what's coming, but getting more and more prepared every day from a supply standpoint and a capacity standpoint. And you specifically asked, Ezra, about our staff, and they have, as I'm not surprised, they have shined a lot through this and are doing wonderful work, cooperating to really get us prepared in all aspects for what's coming and is a bit unknown, but they are completely engaged toward our mission of serving the community and being here when we are needed.
One of the reasons that I wanted to talk to the two of you is because I thought it'd be interesting for people to hear Dr. Mueller, a moment ago, you talked about how your organization has pivoted. And I know the same thing is true of Gunderson and Mayo. Operations at your centers have pivoted to respond to this crisis. And so, Dr. Rathgeber, let's go to you first on this one. Talk a little bit about how your operation has shifted and how have your clinical and hospital resources been kind of redirected toward this effort?
We started with some principles, actually, on why we were behaving the way that we did. And so we really wanted to make sure that we were safe for our patients in our community, safe for our staff, and help decrease the spread, as well as support that distancing that is key and safe at home. But in addition to that, we wanted to make sure that we've had enough capacity in our hospital for the coming surge of COVID-19 patients. Along with that, we wanted to make sure that we had the supplies and the protective equipment in order to care for them in the best way. As you've seen in other parts of the country, they were not as well prepared. So because of that, we cut back on the elective, the things that could be postponed. That's to keep the patients from having to come in and have potential exposure. It also was to help us conserve our supplies. So we have gone to a conservation mode as well as an acquisition mode, looking for as much of the supplies that we need to match the coming surge and not be caught flat-footed, as well as conserving the ones that we have. And so there's been a concerted effort really about preparation. We still have plenty of patients who are having urgent issues, and we are taking care of them as well. But we have freed up some capacity to meet what the models would show are what we need for the coming COVID infections. And I can't say this enough. The more that the public is complying with the orders, it will make sure that we don't overwhelm the system and our capacity.
Dr. Mueller, what about Mayo? How have you redirected either your physical or human resources in response to this?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's very similar to what Dr. Rathgeber said. It's all about planning and preparation for the pandemic. We presume it's coming our way. We have cases in our community. We know there's community spread. We have cases in our hospital. So it gets back to the planning and preparation, and I believe the structure at Gunderson is similar, but we have a hospital incident command system and an incident commander, and there are duties under that system that range from safety, public information, planning, logistics, operations, and so on, each having a leader, and we meet regularly on a daily basis and sometimes multiple times a day, all days of the week. For Mayo Clinic, it also means that as a hub site, we align with our sites in Eau Claire, Mankato, Rochester, as well as Florida and Arizona to some extent, but primarily in the Midwest, and that means pivoting staffing where we need them. So, for example, someone like me, who's a general internist, might actually be reassigned to the hospital if they have competencies in that area, or occupational health, or working in one of our COVID clinics or drive-through clinics or respiratory care clinics. And as Dr. Rathgeber said regarding his staff, our staff are sending us emails. What can we do? We want to help out. This is what we do. This is what we're called to do. What specifically we've done is our emergency department is ready. They have methods for handling patients who are COVID positive or are COVID suspect. We have respiratory care clinics that have been set up in Holman and here for patients who call in concerned. Our hospital is ready for the surge, and we're planning. We plan here and at our other sites for increasing our capacity. We're trying to keep patients out of the clinic if they don't need to be seen. So we've really moved to virtual care. And then I just would like to emphasize what Dr. Rathgeber said. We've really put a stop to elective procedures, even semi-urgent procedures, to be ready for this. But then there are patients who have ongoing medical conditions like cancer that need treatment. We are taking care of those, so the public should be reassured in that regard.
If somebody has a condition or a standing appointment that has been on the books since before this began, either a scheduled surgery or an opportunity where they were supposed to see their doctor about some kind of ongoing issue, if their appointment needs to be canceled or rescheduled, will they be contacted about that, or should people be calling the doctor's office proactively to check on the status of their appointments?
What we've done for patients with outpatient visits or surgeries is we've really gone down the list of patients by department. So if it's a surgical procedure and we ask the question, is this an urgent procedure, semi-urgent, or can it be delayed without putting the patient at risk? If delaying the treatment, for example, if someone has a cancer and they need a surgical procedure, if that puts the patient at risk, then we are determining when does that need to be done and what pathway should be taken to make sure that they're safe coming to our procedure and aren't exposed to COVID. So we have pathways that are being put in place to take care of those patients. The same for outpatient clinic visits, maybe not as urgent. We're going through the list and we're pivoting those patients to visits, telephone or video visits, if it's appropriate.
And Dr. Rathgaber, what about Gunderson?
We are contacting our patients after a thorough review of our schedule from the experts who are taking care of them and deciding if they can be done through a televisit or if they can be postponed if it's a procedure. So we are doing that, and then we are contacting the patients about their options. Again, there are patients that have to be seen. And so we are committed to doing that as well, and we are committed to doing that as safely as possible for those patients.
I want to ask you, our area got pretty high marks at first for social distancing and remaining at home. In the last week, we've heard from police and others that people are getting a little antsy, getting out of their house, spending too much time together, not maybe abiding as closely as they should to the recommendations and even the regulations regarding safer at home. How important is it that people need to stay home, even if they don't see cases of this in their area, maintain proper social distancing, and not be keeping social appointments with people?
Well, it's completely essential for our response. That is how the community can help us. And while we are not seeing an epidemic and a huge number of people in the community, it's because of our good compliance with the safe at home orders. And we are not out of the woods. And so I would greatly encourage folks, especially when the weather's getting nice and people are getting a little cabin fever because they've been complying, please continue to do this. Continue to follow the distancing, continue to wash your hands, continue to try not to, you know, be touching your face, because that will get us back into a more difficult area with having more cases. So we've been very successful, but we must continue along those lines in order to remain successful. This can get out of control very quickly if people start ignoring those orders. So I plead with the public to continue to do the wonderful work they have done and has put us in a good position. But we have cases. We have cases that are hospitalized. We have cases in the community. So we are not immune to the effects of this, and it is not gone. We are just slowing the progress, and that will help us be able to care for our community. But we are not out of the woods, and their help is vital for us to be successful. I cannot overstate that. We need to have people continuing to do this. And I walk to work, and I do see our streets are empty, and there aren't a whole lot of people, whether I'm coming or I'm going. So a lot of people are following this, but there is the natural tendency to start to loosen up because they don't see the same pictures that folks see in New York City. But it's because we've been following that, and it is imperative that people continue to follow that order. It will help us all.
Dr. Mueller, parting words of caution for the public?
I'd echo those completely. A lot of people contact us asking, how can we help? How can we help you battle the pandemic? Well, it's the same as Dr. Rathgaber's message. Help us flatten the curve. Stay home, stay safe. If you get out, practice proper social distancing, wash your hands frequently. Soap and water works really well. Sanitizer if you have it. A lot of people want to give stuff. I would suggest if you want to give in terms of stuff, I would give money to local charities that are trying to help out our communities in need because of the financial and economic impacts of the pandemic. Another area that you can give is giving blood if you're able to do so. When a blood drive is called, and if there's a call because of a shortage. But most important, help us flatten the curve by staying safe, stay home, social distancing. We really cannot overemphasize that.
Dr. Paul Mueller is CEO of Mayo Health Clinic Systems for Southwest Wisconsin. Dr. Mueller, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Dr. Scott Rathgaber is CEO of Gunderson Health System. Dr. Rathgaber, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for the opportunity, Ezra.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from the Southwestern Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Coming up later on our show today, we're talking about how farmers in Wisconsin, dairy farmers in particular, are being affected by the economic uncertainty created by the COVID-19 crisis here in the States and across the world. Also, a representative from the Great Rivers United Way is here with some information about how you can help out during the crisis. And that's all coming up today on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Ezra Wall, and we're talking about the community's response to COVID-19 as we have for the last couple weeks here on Newsmakers. And in particular, today we're joined by Shelley Fortner of the Hunger Task Force. The impetus for this conversation is, of course, with people's work situations being in flux, their school situations being in flux. There are a lot of unknowns in the community right now, and the Hunger Task Force is on the edge of those needs in the La Crosse area all the time, and especially now as people rely on those kinds of resources. Shelley, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Yes, absolutely. It is kind of a difficult time for us, and the Hunger Task Force is a food bank. We're serving about 118 different meal sites and food pantries, in a 7-county area. Most of them are in the La Crosse area. And, we're just going day by day kind of to responding to the need.
So I think that you hit on it, but compared to a normal time, how would you assess the current state of need in our surrounding communities?
Well, I know definitely with, the schools being closed, people are now unemployed for one reason or another, or jobs are, decreasing definitely in hours. There's going to be more people struggling in our area, and we know that. So we're seeing, even with some of the changes in how the pantries and meal sites are providing their services, we're seeing changes in who is coming to access those services.
So you work with pantries and meal sites. How many of each would you estimate that you service?
My guess is mostly the food pantries are the largest number that we serve. There are several meal sites, I'm going to guess right off the top of my head, maybe 14 or so that are serving a congregate meal. But again, they're not doing that right now as they normally do. We also work with youth programs like the Boys and Girls Clubs and, those programs that give lunches to kids. And so all of these programs are changing, and we're trying to keep up with it all.
So you describe the Hunger Task Force as a food bank. For people who might not be familiar with how food distribution operations tend to work, describe what a food bank is.
Yeah, absolutely. So a food bank is a collector. So we have a very large warehouse. We have large drive-in refrigerator, two very large industrial freezers. And so we're able to take food in bulk. Typically, it's not unheard of to have a couple of truckloads come in at the same time. So we are collecting the food. We don't serve individuals from this location, but then we have pantry representatives and meal site representatives come to our warehouse then and choose foods to bring back to their programs.
Okay.
So that's typically how a food bank differs from a food pantry in that we supply the program.
And so you talked about the number of locations that you service being above 100. Was it 120 or so, you said?
118, and we're in 7 counties, the surrounding counties around La Crosse. If they are closer to us than they are to another food bank, we will serve them.
In the state of Wisconsin, is there sort of a general overseer of programs like this? Is there like a network of food banks to make sure that services aren't being duplicated?
Well, we are working with the Hunger Relief Federation of Wisconsin, which is a statewide federation of free and local food banks and programs that work at no charge to the agencies that we serve. And we do have representation in all the counties. So we are working collaboratively across the state, but nobody is really, you know, people are doing their own thing because each individual area is different. And so we have to be, you know, autonomous to our own area so that we can make sure we're doing things the way we see fit for our folks.
We've all seen food collection operations at schools, in community groups, in churches, at the grocery store, whatever, where we've been asked to bring a canned good or bring some non-perishable items to donate. Now that people mm-hmm. are gathering in public less, hopefully not at all, how does that collection process work? How are you generating the supplies that you need?
Well, you know, we have such wonderful area donors that give us fresh produce, you know, distributors and grocers that are giving us fresh produce, and those things have not changed except for that because restaurants are closing and just doing drive-up curbside kinds of services, they have extra products. So we're actually being inundated with fresh stuff, which is really good for us and for the people we serve. But food collections now, as far as non-perishables, we're actually really hurting. And the food drives are not happening because people are a little nervous about that. Definitely, we just found out that the National Association of Letter Carriers is not going to hold the post office food drive in May. And most of the time, we're eagerly waiting for May for that food drive. So we're working, you know, with a number of different organizations to do things separately for us. An example is we are working closely with the county health department, and we're trying to get a citywide food drive put together. It would be a little different because it's going to be a drive-by setup. We're just in the planning stages of that, so I don't have a lot to tell you about that right now. But that's how people are doing things now. It's more of a drive-up kind of a, you know, take it out of my car kind of situation. So we're learning day by day how to do the same things and meet the same needs, but we just have to do it a little differently.
If people are maybe who are trying to only go to the grocery store for their own most urgent needs, and if they're not ready to participate in some kind of public thing like that,
right.
are you able to put monetary donations to use, or do you have purchasing arrangements with organizations to get bulk orders of food?
Yes, absolutely, and that is really helpful right now, probably more than ever, because we do have those relationships and we can get that food ordered and just get it directly from the distributor, and then folks don't have to leave their house or you know congregate to you know give it a food drive. So cash donations are extremely important right now. We can get the things that we need, and it's a little bit more of a streamlined process.
Once people do start hearing about maybe the community drop-off site in their area, or if somebody's church or school office is still offering drop-off collections for those kinds of things, what are the things that are most in need? I know non-perishables, but that's a pretty broad category. Are there specific
right.
things that you tend to need more often?
Yeah, we have a top five or six items that we are always in need of. And these are things that are easy to make a meal out of. We don't want to just give one person one sandwich. We'd like to give them, you know, where they can make a family meal. So really good things for us to do that with are pasta sauce, those kinds of things. Canned soup is can be a meal. We look for peanut butter, you know, those things that you can put together and make a good-sized meal out of versus one sitting for one person. You know, we accept everything, obviously, but our main things are peanut butter, canned tuna, you know, pasta sauce, things like that. You could put those together and make a meal.
So the things that some of us who are privileged might look in our cabinets and go, oh, that again? Those might be some of those items that might really be a blessing to people in need.
Exactly. Yeah, you can do so much with with spaghetti or pasta. You can put anything in that. You can put our fresh produce, broccoli, or something in this pasta, mac and cheese, that kind of stuff. You can really stretch that pasta to make a nice meal and pretty much add anything to it.
Indeed so. Where can people find more information about the Hunger Task Force and maybe a link to donate or something like that?
Well, check us out on Facebook. We're putting updates on there on what we're doing. You can certainly donate through our website, www.lacrossehtf.org. We are, you know, we're really looking for the community support in any way, in any safe way that we can do that. And donating online is a perfect way to help right from your home.
Yeah, there's no restrictions on online access, except some parts of the day your internet might be a little slow these days. So the website again is lacrossehtf.org?
Correct.
All right. We've been speaking with Shelley Fortner of the Hunger Task Force. Shelley, thank you very much again for what you're doing for our community and for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from the Southwestern Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find all of our contact information on our website. You can find past episodes of the program there as well. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in just a moment. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall, and we're talking about COVID-19. We're talking about how different industries and sectors in Wisconsin, and especially in the Cooley region and throughout the Driftless area, are reacting to COVID-19, how they're being affected by it. A big industry in Wisconsin, well, agriculture is a big sector of our economy, and the dairy industry itself is a huge player in the Wisconsin agricultural industry, always has been. And right now I'm pleased to be joined by Darren Von Ruden, who's a dairy farmer from Westby, also the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Ezra.
And so basically, you personally, as well as the people that you deal with through the Farmers Union, give us a report on what the state of Wisconsin's dairy industry and other agricultural industries is in the wake of COVID-19.
Well, very concerning would probably be the best way to explain it. You know, right now, all of our commodity markets are falling. Dairy has fallen 27-28% in the last 2 weeks here now. We went from probably a $17 to $18 midsummer pay price down to right now looking at in the $12.50 to $12.75 pay range for this summer. So not good at all. It's the average cost of production for dairy farmers in the state of Wisconsin is pushing the $20 per hundredweight cost. And so if we're going to be looking at $12.50 to $12.75 as a pay price midsummer, you know, we're losing $7 plus automatically before we even get up in the morning. And so there's grave concerns there. The corn and soybean farmers are, some corn farmers are still trying to get corn off the field from last year yet, waiting for the spring thaw to get done with here. And then we end up getting rain every couple of days. So, they're still struggling trying to deal with last year's crop. As far as this year, their crop prices, the pay prices are not looking good at all right now. So it's really a struggling time for the agricultural sector here right now.
The commodities markets are unstable, to say the least. They're down. And you're seeing that effect. But in terms of and it's happened in the last couple of weeks because of uncertainty in the economy. Is there some more specific connection to the illness that's going around, or is it just that uncertainty that's causing markets to be unstable?
I would say it's really the uncertainty on what's going to happen and where the consumer preferences are going to go, which draws another a question in a lot of dairy farmers' minds anyway right now, is with our prices dropping the way they are and we go to the local grocery store not any more than we have to, but you go in and the dairy sectors are kind of empty. There's some stores that only have a few gallons of milk and only one or two cheese selections. Why are prices, futures prices especially, dropping at a point in time when there isn't a full dairy aisle in the grocery stores anymore?
Yeah, I'm not an economist, but we've always been told that these things go kind of, supply and demand is the principle that drives all of that. And you would think that demand would be high when shelves are empty.
Right. And that's the frustrating part about what's going on. And is the question, is it price gouging by certain entities that's causing, the price to fall to farmers and the price to raise to consumers? Because the supply and demand was in effect, really farmer prices should be going up with consumer prices, and they're in the opposite direction right now.
There's been a request from the governor's office instructing the Department of Agriculture here in Wisconsin to suggest to their national counterparts that the government get involved in purchasing surplus dairy to distribute to food banks, to people who normally would participate in school lunch programs, and to low-income individuals. Is that something that you're familiar with and would be supportive of?
Yes, very supportive of it. Normally the USDA buys for school lunch programs anyway. Right now, there are some schools that are still doing home deliveries to students that are not able to attend classes because schools are shut down. So the question is, are those people going to be shorted on dairy products that they shouldn't be, being that it seems like there's this issue of not enough cheese in some spots?
Comparing the difficulties of the last couple of weeks, talk about what before a couple of weeks ago, what was going on in either the dairy industry or throughout farming in Wisconsin. What has the general positive or negative experience of farmers been in the last year in Wisconsin?
Well, on the dairy side, especially leading into late fall or early winter, milk prices were coming up. They were getting to be at a level where farmers could actually get their nose above water again. And at that time was when farmers needed to sign up for some federal programs to look at an insurance program where you could make sure that you're covering your cost of production. So a lot of farmers at that time decided, the futures market was in the 18.5 to $19 range for the full year 2020. So things were looking really good as far as dairy goes. And then all of a sudden we seen the coronavirus start to affect different parts of the world, but that affected the futures market here in the United States. And within 2 months of the close of that sign up period, all of a sudden we were looking at futures markets for the full year down in the $14.5 to $15 range. Right now, the futures markets are looking to be in the $13 range. So farmers, you know, are always gamblers, to say. One thing that we do, we've become used to that. But in a situation like this, when you're, you know, in an unusual time, farmers are going to have to need some assistance, similar to what we're looking at for the airline industry and some of the other major sectors of the economy. Just number one, to keep food on the shelves and keep it coming, but two, to make sure that we have a generation of farmers that will be here in 15, 20 years to keep supporting the country's food needs.
So when restaurants are doing lower business, we remind people of their existence. In other places, we can remind people of the importance of supporting the local economy. When farmers are used to dealing with their product on such a massive scale, and are not like dairy farmers, for example, you know, dairy farmers don't have like bottling operations at their specific farm or whatever. How can the public help or participate in the recovery of that industry?
Well, you know, I think certainly eat more dairy products. You know, it's interesting that, you know, we've continued to see increased consumption of dairy products, but farmer pay prices are lower. So, you know, maybe it's more of the monopolies that we're seeing in this country. You know, fewer and fewer buyers out there, so the dairy farmers have less and less options. And then also the consumer really has less and less options to go and buy their product from. You know, just a point of clarification on your statement too, there is a growing number of farms across the country that actually have processing capacity on the farm. And some of them deal directly with restaurants, but and then other ones do deal directly to the consumer base too. And you know, I think having that diversity is good for those areas where they have those options. But maybe we should be looking at a structure of agriculture that has more of that local option and not be so dependent on either national processing organizations or even international processing organizations like we're moving towards in this country.
So on a more short-term basis, to your point of more dairy farms having those kinds of processing operations, how can somebody go about sourcing more locally derived dairy products?
Well, most of them nowadays have websites and have communication mechanisms where you can at least find out what they're about before you actually go visit the farm. But really, you know, if there's a local farm that has a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Movement, they're very used to communicating with their members and their friends of the members, too, to make sure that they can get fresh vegetables and meats and dairy products direct from the farms. So those mechanisms are out there. We just need to expand their knowledge and use of them.
Well, it certainly is an interesting and in many ways troubling time. And I thank you very much for shedding some light on the plight of our farmers here in Wisconsin. Darren Van Ruden is a dairy farmer himself and also the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Ezra.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau. You can find our program online at WPR.org/newsmakers. I'd love to hear from you. Our contact information is available on that page as well. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers, and you're listening here to the Southwestern Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you so much for joining us today. We've been talking about the community's further response to COVID-19 as it continues to make its way across our region. A program I saw online this week that looks interesting is called You Get Connected, and it's sponsored or headed up in part by the Great Rivers United Way, and we're speaking now with Julie Nelson of the Great Rivers United Way Julie, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Glad to be here.
So tell me about You Get Connected. What is it?
You Get Connected is a community-wide volunteer site that people can go online and find a variety of volunteer opportunities. We have four partners altogether. United Way is one of them. And then the three secondary educational institutions. So Viterbo University, University of Wisconsin La Crosse, and Western Wisconsin Technical College are all part of it. So it's especially helpful for students because so many of them have community service hours that they need to put in. But it's really a community-wide resource. So you'll especially notice when this whole COVID thing is over, you can go there and you can find food pantries to help, gardens to help with, and just almost any organization that needs some help. You just click on there, set up a profile, and you can volunteer. So it's a one-stop shop for people who want to volunteer and get involved in the community.
So it really is, it's tapping into that volunteering instinct and also helping people who might need to engage in volunteering on a more official basis.
Yeah, uh-huh. Whether you need to volunteer to fulfill a requirement of some sort, or you just want to because you feel it's the right thing to do, or you want to get out and meet new people, you want to get involved, whatever the reason, this is there for you to help connect to the community.
Now, this is a resource that's always available, but in the wake of and in response to COVID-19, you've sort of got a special section of the website going now that has opportunities that people can perform from home.
Yeah, we have in the You Get Connected site what we call initiatives. So it's two little boxes that you'll see on there. One says COVID-19 volunteer opportunities, and it's things that you can do at home without going out and meeting other people. The ones at United Way have organized are sewing masks. So we're working with the county health department. So there's a template that you can use, a pattern, download that and sew some masks for that. Then there's a drop-off place by Isle La Plume. And these will go out to some of the nursing homes and secondary units where they don't have the great need for the N95 mask, but they do want something better than nothing. And then there's some other neat things where any member of the family can do this. Stay at home and write some letters, cards, posters, drawings, whatever it is, for people in nursing homes. How easy is that? Our folks in nursing homes are completely isolated. They're allowed no visitors. Oftentimes, they don't understand how to work the technology, so they can't Skype or do a Zoom meeting or whatever with their friends and relatives. So just to have someone reach out in some way and send a little note of cheer is so appreciated. And then another one that we just started is our healthcare workers are just on the front lines of all this. They're worried. They're trying hard not to infect their patients. They're afraid to go home and infect their families. So it's an email thing that you can do. You can select a card and then type out your message. Thanks to any healthcare worker. Thanks for doing what you're doing or whatever it is you'd like to say. And then we'll send those emails on to a variety of healthcare facilities. They'll pass them on to their workers and just let them know how much they're appreciated in the community.
That sounds like great ideas, all. In particular, I was struck when you were talking about people in a nursing home or assisted living facility or something who might not be aware of how to work the technology necessary to keep them connected to people during a time when they can't receive visitors. Under normal circumstances, some of them might be able to receive help from some of the staff at those facilities, but with extra demands being placed on those staff members, there's not the time to make sure that happens. And in addition to people not knowing how, some of them may not physically be able, if they can't operate their hands like they used to, or if they can't maybe see the buttons on the machines like they used to, or something like that.
That's exactly right. And the staff, even if they have the time, they're really hesitant to get that close to the person because you just never know when you might have picked up something and they would hate like heck to infect someone just by coming and, pressing some keys on an iPad for them. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very difficult time. It's extremely challenging for them to stay connected electronically.
So you work with the Great Rivers United Way in community outreach. Talk about how Wow, what a different operation that is during these times when people can't be outside connecting face-to-face like they normally are.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. When this thing started, I thought, oh my gosh, what am I possibly going to do? Because this is my job to connect with the community, and everything in the community I've been working on is shutting down and being postponed. But ironically, I've been just a little busier than I might have been otherwise, trying to get the thing with the nursing home all figured out logistically and publicized, and now the bit with the email things for the healthcare workers, once again, to meet with people and get it organized and get the word out. So yeah, oddly, it's a very different animal, but it's still very important, and finding different ways for the community to stay connected and give back to their communities.
So if people want to get to the, if they want to get connected to the You Get Connected website, first of all, we should say that the letter U, Get Connected, is how that's styled. And what website do they need to go to access those opportunities?
Yeah, so it's www.getconnected.org. And then you should see two banners that say COVID-19 volunteer opportunities or in-kind COVID-19 response. And the in-kind thing is a little bit more of the sewing the masks. And then we had one Eagle Crest, one of the Eagle Crests anyway, said, you know what we would love would be some small gifts for our staff, because they are working so hard and they're stressed out. It could be some small lotions because they're washing their hands all the time. Maybe just little candies that we could hand out as prizes, but those kind of in-kind gifts. I think we're working on trying to contact other community partners. We've heard of people that would like some art supplies. So as we find out those things, we'll put those up too. So if you are willing and able to do some of those in-kind things, that is an opportunity as well. But yes, as your first question said, yougetconnected.org. You can shop around. It says volunteer now. Hit that button first. See if there's something you like. And once you find something you like, then you can go ahead and create a profile. And you can select some of the things you like to do. So it'll just send you an email anytime something comes up. If you like stuffing envelopes, if you like volunteering at a road race, once those things come up, it'll just say, hey, Ezra, there's this volunteer opportunity that you like. Would you like to take part? If you don't want to, you don't have to, but it's a real convenient way to find out things that are going on you might be interested in without having to search around every single day.
Yeah, well, and it's nice to know that when something like that comes up, it'll reach out and give you that little prompt.
Exactly. Sometimes you don't want to spend every single day on there. You don't want to miss anything either. So it's a very handy method that way.
So anybody can set up a profile. Do they have to belong to any particular organization or something like that?
No, we ask that they be nice people. But beyond that, no requirement at all.
That seems like a very reasonable bar to set. All right. So yougetconnected.org, the letter U, getconnected.org is the website. And our guest today is Julie Nelson from the Great Rivers United Way. If people are interested in finding out more about Great Rivers United Way, or even more broadly, the United Way in general and the work that you're doing, how do they find you online?
At www.gruw.org would do it. So that stands for Great Rivers United Way. And they can find some of these things that we're doing. They'll also find the community fund that we've set up, so that if people want to donate, or their agencies that want to apply for some of this these funds, then we can help with that and try and help our community keep going during this COVID crisis.
All right, Julie Nelson of the Great Rivers United Way, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it very much.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall here in our Southwest Bureau, and glad that you've joined us today. You can find us anytime online. You can listen to past episodes of our show. Better yet, you can tell us what you'd like to hear in the future. Ask a question we haven't answered yet. Tell us about a guest you'd like to hear on our program. You can find our website. It's www.wpr.org/newsmakers. For my producer, John Davis, I'm Ezra Wall, hoping that you'll join us again next time on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.